Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guests, Joe Heschmeyer, apologist here at Catholic Answers, Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, who apparently is trying to get out of the job. And maybe I misinterpreted something. I don't know.
I'm going to die.
I'm sorry to hear that.
You are as well.
Oh, not right away, though.
But someone will want to continue the work of Catholic Answers after I'm dead.
That's right.
That's all.
That's right. They just won't be as good at as you are. That's all I was saying.
They'll be different.
Different as in not as good.
He or she will be different, not they'll. Let's get the pronoun.
I don't want it to get into grammar because I have strong feelings about that they or that plural singular. But we're going to get into more news of the world from a Catholic perspective. But Tom Nash, first of all, bringing Tom Nash into this building, one of the best things you've ever done. I have so much fun with Tom Nash in here.
Tom is great.
He helps us out so much. But he also
100% team player.
He virtually every day has an idea for how to make this show better. Virtually every day.
And like one out of 10 are good.
No, they're probably all good. I only listen to about half of them.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, Tom Nash. He said to me, well, if you're going to do flannel panel, will you talk about how Catholics are really good at celebrating Lent, but we're not so good at celebrating the Easter octave or the Easter season?
He's right.
Okay, I wondered if you guys would be sympathetic. Are you sympathetic to that, Joe?
Yeah, absolutely. Partly because we know what to do. And I think partly because we kind of feast most of the year.
Oh, that's a good point.
You know, like it's hard to, like, I don't know how to dial this up anymore. You know, that can be kind of the, you're telling me to
How many TV dinners can I eat?
Exactly. So I really do think that there is an unfortunate sense of not knowing how to feast.
Yeah.
I was actually asked about this yesterday. And one of the things I pointed out, like, we just try to incorporate some little thing every day. So we're going to go share an ice cream after the show. And it's something the kids are looking forward to.
They're going
to
get one ice cream and all six of you.
That's all they can afford.
He's an apologist. That's all he can afford.
Yeah, exactly.
He just said we're going to share an ice cream.
We're going to share a banana split with because it's two adults and three small kids.
That has three scoops in it. Yeah. Yeah.
There's plenty. No one is going to go without enough. And you do something like that where it's a small but deliberate thing. You explicitly pair it with Easter. And then you maybe read like a children's story. In our case, we have small kids of like, what is it called? The story of all stories. The fantastic kind of retelling of the biblical stories at a level the kids can understand. Emily Stimson wrote that. It's great. You do something like that where they're looking forward to it. They know it's because Jesus rose from the dead. That builds a kind of, temperate rejoicing.
Do you say we're doing these things because it's Easter? We're celebrating resurrection of Jesus?
Absolutely. And then, the two-year-old knows.
So the two-year-old knows we're getting ice cream because Jesus rose from the dead.
Yep.
That's great.
That's right.
That's great. That's actually was Tom's idea. Tom said, why don't you as parents have a treat every day of the octave of Easter and say, the sweetest thing that ever happened is Jesus rose from the dead. And so we get sweets to celebrate Jesus.
I took a walk with my two-year-old today and I told him it was springtime and he said, no, it's Easter time.
Oh, good for
him. That.
Good for
him. So, yeah, he's taking it to heart. And so it's really, we can overthink it. I think the harder thing, honestly, is if you're, a single person living by yourself saying, what do I do to celebrate here? Have some friends over. Do something to sort of rejoice.
I think just have a banana split. What are you talking about, Joe? You gave the answer. Everybody, go get a banana split and celebrate the resurrection of the Lord. Do you have one at home still?
Nathaniel's out, but he's back. It's hard to say exactly. But
you're going to do something extra nice?
He has a job up in San Marcos. He doesn't get home in time for dinner. But we've been grilling. And Yeah, we're celebrating.
You know what I do, and I probably shouldn't say this in front of Chris, but I do no work during the work hours. I just don't. I don't put any effort in at all.
But
this
what
week.
Do you do during Easter?
Rock it off, Joe. All right. Well, I'm glad we got to that. You're a horrible person.
Can I just say that I think when we feasting, we talk about food, obviously, because
true.
Yeah, those things are related.
I think they might even come from the same root word.
but it's funny that. I don't know if funny is the word. So people will say, for my Lenten sacrifice or something, I'm going to make a commitment to going to daily mass a couple times a week or something like that, or maybe every day, right? But why not celebrate the resurrection by every day in the octave is a solemnity?
Yeah.
So, I mean, if your priest is doing what he's supposed to be doing, he should be in gold vestments today. And Father Fadi sang the sequence in Latin. It was so beautiful before the gospel here today. So ramp up your liturgical activity.
That's a good point.
During the octave.
Well, I knew we had mass here today. My wife got up and went to mass this morning. And because her Lenten observance, one of her Lenten observances was, I'm going to make it to Mass every day in Lent, because she's a convert to the Catholic faith. She's never been a daily communicant. So she gets up this morning and starts getting ready for Mass. And she says it in the most comical, exasperated way. She goes, I guess I'm a person that goes to Mass every day now. And then she goes off to
praise God.
Like it just had like 40 days of it. Well, now I guess I'm one of those people.
Go home and tell her that is the most Catholic thing you could have ever said, Missy. That's wonderful.
Yeah, I guess I'm one of them. So, yeah, off to Mass she went. So that's a very good point, though. Yeah. So start the day with Mass. End the day with a banana split. The Lord is risen. How's that? Does that sound like a...
Well, right. You know, our office was closed on Monday. We're closed on Easter Monday.
And I think that's... Mm-hmm. That you added that, right?
I did.
See, that's why I'm saying there's nobody like you, Chris.
Who can give days off?
A really good day, because I do find this. And even with the kids grown and everything now, you enjoy Easter so much knowing that...
You're not going to work the next day.
The next day is day off. Easter Sunday is so relaxed because you're... iron a shirt, or not like I iron my shirts. I just threw that in there, but I mean, you know, for people
not a single person in this. Maybe John Versillo
irons his shirts.
He's probably the only. Well, probably Sarah does it.
Yeah, John's not ironing his shirt. Yeah. John doesn't know how to use an iron. Like, what do you? No. All right. So here's a story from EWTN News. I want to see what you think about it. As I said, we have missed doing a flannel panel for several months. So these are not all new stories. Like the Peter Thiel one, that was not a new story. EWTN News from, let me see the date on
new
this one.
New Pope.
Yeah, we have a new Pope, Leo. What do you guys think? Any commentary on that? No, this goes back to March 20th.
I think he's going to be great.
I think he's going to be great. March 20th from EWTN News, Almedina Martinez Bourdieu wrote, priest unafraid of prison for defending teaching on homosexuality. I must fight for the Lord. For stating the church's teaching on homosexuality on a radio show, a priest in Iceland finds himself under attack by a gay rights group that is citing the nation's law affirming homosexuality. This, I think, this connects to another story that we also missed, but I will mention it, where the Pope Leo's ambassador to the UN warned that so-called, and he put this in quotes, new rights are displacing the old rights. And God bless Pope Leo for standing up and saying the obvious, which is if you say everybody has the right to and name your whatever, and then you subsequently say, and it's a hate crime to speak against that, if that new right that you invented is something that the Bible, for example, speaks about, you're going to have to put all the Christians in jail. And that's what's happening. People think, oh, that's an exaggeration. No, Sweden, we've had lawsuits and criminal prosecutions of people who defend the biblical teaching on human sexuality. And here's this priest in Reykjavik, in the Diocese of Reykjavik, who literally is being threatened with jail because he is violating the no conversion therapy law of the nation of Iceland.
15 years ago, there was a priest in Canada. I don't know if either of you guys recall that. I don't remember his
Same
name.
Thing?
Yeah,
oh,
who, I don't remember who was called before, hauled before the, I don't know, the cultural.
Oh, they have the Human Rights Commission.
Yeah, or, yeah, exactly. Canada. Yeah, yeah. I was going to say cultural tribunal or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, it's a tribunal. Yeah,
yeah, but who was hauled before them? And I don't know that he received jail time, but there was some kind of censure.
Well,
but this priest, in fact, did not say that he advocated or that the church did, because she does not, so-called conversion therapy. What he said was the inclination to homosexual acts itself is not a sin, but acting on that inclination is, and the church accompanies these people with these temptations. That's what he said. And I think accompaniment was heard to be conversion therapy.
Well, something. He actually used the, he unfortunately said this crazy phrase. This is insane. We are all called to conversion in Christ. Yeah. I can't believe he would say something so intolerant and brutal. And that triggered the conversion therapy law. We'll get into that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Support for Catholic Answers Live comes from the Graduate School of Theology at Christendom College. Deepen your understanding of the Catholic faith through live online graduate courses taught with uncompromising fidelity to the Church's magisterium, from Christology and bioethics to Mariology and more. This summer, you can also attend the Institute for Liturgical Formation on campus. Begin your master's degree or earn a certificate at graduatetheology.com. That's graduatetheology.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
EWTN has its own official YouTube channel with tens of thousands of videos covering just about every conceivable topic of interest to Catholics. And best of all, it's free. Every day, EWTN adds new TV shows, live events, devotionals, homilies, and specials to its YouTube channel. Visit the EWTN YouTube channel today. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. We're talking about Iceland. That's usually not good these days. Iceland has become apparent. I mean, Iceland congratulated themselves on curing. They cured, and I know you know exactly what I'm about to refer to. Mm-hmm. They cured Down syndrome. I remember that when they congratulated themselves a few years ago for that. You can guess what the cure was, and now. They are leading the world in standing up for everybody's right to love everybody by saying, well, we should probably put this priest in jail for saying that everyone should be converted to Christ and that homosexual acts are sinful. The priest, by the way, you should know, is French. There's not it seems, at least from the tenor of this article, there's not really a native Catholic community in Iceland. It's all people who have come there
Iceland
to work.
Went Lutheran. So Iceland had been pagan. They'd been like Viking. And then they were Christian for a few hundred years. And then they became Lutheran. Sorry, they
well,
became
Lutherans
Catholic
are
for a few hundred years. And then
yeah.
I misspoke. That was not intentional as a slight.
It was. You did that on purpose.
No, although the Lutherans there now, apparently the Lutheran Church in Iceland is pretty extreme.
Yeah, they're kind of post-Christian.
That's why they're not having problems with the conversion therapy ban, apparently.
Yeah, and but so what I mean is, like, there's not a native-born Catholic community there now. And so the Catholics who are there are Poles or they are—
North Poles, actually.
Oh, my goodness. And that, or they're Filipinos, which, if you're a Filipino, I get the—you know, Filipinos are wonderful about—they migrate all— Iceland? Really? You can come here to San Diego. It's you're Filipino and you went to Iceland? That must have been a heck of a job offer.
I feel like a lot of them have.
Gone to Iceland?
No, come here to San Diego.
Yeah, they should.
We have two here at Catholic Answers.
We love Filipinos here. You should come here. Yes. We want more Filipinos. Stay out of Iceland. Well, it's crazy. Well, maybe it's island living. Maybe they like the island living.
They like being close to fish.
Well, and who doesn't? But I don't know what to say about this, except that this makes me think Peter Thiel is right. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I feel like this is a kind of antichrist modernity. There is a way of being modern that is antichrist and anti-Christian, and it insists that everybody get along with it. It doesn't want to get along with anybody. It insists that everyone get along with it, so that people who don't go along, like everybody in this priest, everybody that comes to mass with this priest went there voluntarily because they share his religion. They pay for him. You know, they give their money to the church. He preaches the Catholic faith. And the state, or it's not the entire state of Iceland, but certain members of the Althing or the parliament there are now accusing this guy of intolerance and violating the law because he just was Catholic.
I mean, if you listen to his account of what he said, he was asked a question by a woman who was living with another woman about whether, if she became Catholic, could she receive communion? And he told her that she would have to live in accordance with the teachings of the church, which should not be a shocking thing. It wasn't like he, you know, went out and started egging the lady's house. You know, he was asked a direct question, gave the only possible answer he could give, and then was accused of violating a law that was intended, or at least worded in such a way, that you weren't allowed to use deception. Let me find that. You can't use force, deception, or threats to induce an individual to undergo treatment for the purpose of suppressing or changing his or her sexuality, gender identity, or gender expression. It's like none of that happened here. It was just, what is the church's position? And so it seems like if this is going to be the position they take, we're right back to 1550 when Iceland outlawed Catholicism and you were just legally not allowed to be Catholic.
That's where we're
and
going.
And I might add, not allowed to be Muslim either. And so I wish they would just say that outright. Like, you cannot in Iceland be Catholic or Muslim or a traditional Christian of any kind, and then see where that goes. Because when you put it in the vague and warm sounding therapeutic language, but then enforce that therapeutic sounding law against anyone who answers a question about Catholicism correctly.
Right.
You know what you've done. Like, this is the velvet glove on the iron fist. Like, it's a nice outward expression, a nice patina, as you would say, Cy. But underneath, it is just, you know, it's just the suppression of traditional Christian views.
I feel like this is another one of the proofs of the truth of the Catholic faith, or the Catholic Church, you know, ecclesially. It's the one thing, it's the one organization that people want to belong to. But on their terms. So this woman is not having an interview with a Methodist, saying, "Do I have to do what the Methodist Church teaches?"
Because the Methodist minister is like, you can come on in.
Yeah,
we love you.
Whatever. I suppose Islam to some extent fits this description as well, but I don't know that there are a lot of people trying to break down the door to become Muslims, but everyone who is living, many people who are living a life contrary to the moral teaching of the church want to be accepted by the Catholic Church. Yeah. They don't really care if the Methodist Church accepts them.
Well, I go back again to the great quote of Lenny Bruce. There's only one, the church. Yes, and everybody knows what it is.
That's right.
So he's exactly right about that. Could I criticize my fellow Christians here for a moment and see if you all agree with me on this? I think our evangelical brothers and sisters, or fundamentalist brothers and sisters, do us a great disservice in this, because they publicly say homosexuality is a sin And that is wrong. You should not say that because you
need to be clarified what is meant by it.
It needs to be much clearer. This priest taught the Christian faith when he said, look, the inclination is not a sin. We're not saying that the inclination is a sin. The act is a sin. So if I could just encourage my evangelical brothers and sisters, the act is a sin. The feeling, the inclination, the unchosen disposition is not a sin. And so stop oversimplifying this because you're getting people in trouble. You're making it more difficult for us to get along with people who already don't want to get along with us.
The other important element of this teaching, and it's something that my brother, when he was head of Courage, stressed over and over and over, is what personhood is. And homosexuality is not someone's identity.
No.
So he always made this distinction between person, inclination, and action. Person, inclination, and action.
Person, inclination, and action. Yeah. Yes,
and
beautiful.
You are not a homosexual. If you have inclinations or same-sex attraction, this is why, that's why they use this word, same-sex attraction, that doesn't mean that your identity is homosexual. That's Joe, not an identity.
Joe, I'm just trying to help you sell books here. Who would I go to if I wanted to find my identity? Who would I go?
Yes, I have a book called Who Am I, Lord? Finding Your Identity in Christ. Because everyone has a hunger for identity. Like the people who say, like, you are destroying me by attacking my identity, they're mistaken, but I get it. I mean, we all need a sense of who we are.
Yes.
And your identity is the foundation of your behavior. You know, if you discovered tomorrow that you were the king of Spain, you would make different actions. If you discovered tomorrow you were no longer employed by Catholic Answers, your day would look different. You behave differently based on who you understand yourself to be, and you can't operate coherently in the world without some sense of identity. Like, you simply cannot. Like, if let's say you woke up in the middle of a soccer match and you don't know which team you're on, or if you're the ref, or if you're supposed to be in the stands, you've got no idea what to do. And so identity is this vitally important thing. And everyone has to give some answer of who they are. And it might be multi-factor, but, you know, there might be different parts to your identity. But there needs to be some cohesive sense of, when all is said and done, this is the most important part of who I am. And it was diabolical, pernicious, and incredibly effective for people promoting deviant sexual lifestyles to say, this is the most important part of who you are.
Yeah,
this is your identity. And if you don't act on this, you're not being true to yourself.
Yeah.
Like, if you said this in any other context, it would be transparently laughable. If you said, you know,
I'm a shoplifter.
Sorry, Missy,
I'm a shoplifter.
My identity is I'm really into blondes.
Yeah.
She would not be like, well, you be true to yourself.
Yeah. No.
She'd be like, too bad, buddy.
Yeah.
And rightly so. Like, yeah. It's absurd to say that. And so if you say, you know, like, let's say you're married and you decide your identity is bisexual. Does that mean you can't be faithful in your marriage because you're not being true to both halves of that? Although even the idea there are two sexes might be itself kind of conservative these days. You know, like the whole idea of making sexual orientation or attraction a constitutive part of your identity is absurd when you get down to it. It might be a piece of how you live. Like, I'm attracted to people in this way and I have to respond to that set of attractions. Fine. But don't make it your identity. It's certainly not the core of your identity. And the core of your identity is something so much nobler. You're a son or a daughter of God. And you are made by God without a mistaking, you know, your body reveals who you are in its fundamental nature.
Yeah.
Like, you want to know the orientation of your body? Take a look at it in the mirror. It'll tell you, you know, pieces of the puzzle fit together. And so that idea of just discovering who you are at the deepest level, this is not about suppressing or destroying your identity. This is about understanding your identity in a smarter, more coherent, more cohesive sort of way.
Well, beautifully said, Joe. Perfectly said. And I'm glad I mentioned the book because it beautifully said. But let me ask you this. So in one country, not just one country, actually, this is starting to spread around Scandinavia and in other parts of the world, you see this as well. People are being threatened with jail under the rainbow banner. That you violated the rainbow banner. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States, you might see a Midwestern Catholic school flying the rainbow banner out front. Would either of you see that as a betrayal by Catholics here in the United States of Catholics who are being persecuted under that banner elsewhere.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the attempts to excuse it don't work. This is what's called semiotics. Like, the sign value of a thing is not something completely within your control. And if you know someone is going to receive a sign in a certain way and you choose to use it, you're responsible for that. So flying the pride flag, even if you claim, oh, we just meant we're very accepting of everyone, we're not endorsing sexual sin, it doesn't work. I mean, if you decide you're going to put up a Hindu good luck symbol and everyone reads it as a German symbol from the mid-20th century, you had to kind of know that was going to be what people interpreted it as. And so you can't be like, well, to me it means... No, stop. Just don't play that game.
To me it means, no. There's a public...
I mean, this is the...
We're social creatures. There's a public dimension to these things. Yeah.
Right, exactly. This is... Signs are not the kind of thing that have private meaning simply in your mind.
No,
because a sign is communication to another person.
Unless you're a rabbit who says words mean precisely what I intend them to mean. You know,
nice Alice in Wonderland reference.
Thank you very much.
I think it's Humpty Dumpty the egg.
Oh, that's Humpty Dumpty that says that? Well, it's still, I was pretty literary.
Which came first, the rabbit or the egg? It could be a rabbit egg.
We'll be right back.
Those only exist at Easter.
The world recently found itself with one less person who thinks the world has too many people. We will talk about the death of Paul Ehrlich right after this. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin Podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
What is the Catholic Church? Everyone seems to have an opinion, but the church never quite fits into the boxes people make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the Church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers. Joe Heschmeyer, apologist here at Catholic Answers, joined me for flannel panel today. It used to be every month, but now it's like every 6 months or something, because these guys are so popular. It's hard to get them here.
Well, you're traveling a great deal yourself there.
Not because I'm popular.
I think you're pretty popular.
It's nice to have you here. And so not all of these stories are yesterday's. They didn't just come across yesterday. This is another March 20th article from EWTN News. Amira Abuzaid.
She's great. She's my friend.
You know her, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
how
she lives in...
You know so many people. How do you know
that's
her?
That's actually not true. I know so many people. But I know her. She lives in Houston.
She wrote a piece called "Death of Doomsday Population Prophet Prompts Retrospection by Catholic thought leaders. Prominent Catholic scholars say the late Paul Ehrlich's ideas were, and she puts this in quote, diabolical, and helped lead to millions of deaths through forced population control measures. There's no question that that is correct, what she is saying. Paul Ehrlich, the biologist whose 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb, warned of imminent mass starvation and environmental catastrophe from overpopulation, and whose predictions proved spectacularly wrong, died March 13th at the age of 93. His death has prompted retrospection among Catholic scholars who lambasted his legacy as a false prophet, whose ideas fueled deadly population control policies. The thing is, with a false prophet, people don't want to hear what the false prophet has to say. They won't listen. There's been plenty of false prophets nobody ever heard of, but people like Walter Cronkite and Johnny Carson and other prominent cultural elites bought into this nonsense hook, line, and sinker, and the consequences were devastating. Literally millions of lives either brutalized, extinguished, or prevented because of population control policies in the 1970s, and that continue in some places up till today. The Chinese destroyed their entire culture, and the Chinese culture of yesteryear does not exist and will never exist again, because the Chinese killed so many of their children and allowed only one child. And now we have word from demographers that China is in demographic winter. It will never recover. Barring an act of the Holy Spirit, which we can pray for the good of the Chinese people, who God loves and wants more of and always wanted more of, barring an act of the Holy Spirit, China will never recover from what it did to itself. Its population is in permanent decline.
The northeast of China, the birth rate is at what is called extinction levels.
Yeah. They've destroyed themselves.
0.52 children being born per person.
Ehrlich famously said this beautiful scientific, it's just so, devoted to the calm and deliberate language of the scientist. The battle to feed all of humanity is over. This was in 1968. In the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash program embarked upon now. That's probably his most famous quote. Now, and of course, there has been tremendous suffering in the modern world from starvation. Virtually every year, things have gotten better in that regard.
It's funny when Paul Ehrlich was getting traction. He was working off of Thomas Malthus, who had already been discredited a century before.
Thomas Malthus, who said that the basic Malthusian calculation that everyone talks about is that agricultural goods increase
arithmetically. Yeah.
Population increases
exponentially. Yeah.
And so that means eventually we're all going to run out of food. This is why economics, which Malthus is one of the founders of, is called the dismal science. Because people looked at the first works of economics by people. Now, this is not true of all economists, but Malthus himself is why economics is called the dismal science. Talk about dismal. The idea is very soon, according to Paul Ehrlich, we will have so many people that we can't feed them. That never happened. It was never going to happen. It cannot happen. There is no such thing as overpopulation. The word itself is a lie. If a ship sinks and there's too many people in a lifeboat, that means there's too many people in the lifeboat. That's not overpopulation.
It's a scale question.
That's a lack of lifeboats.
Yeah.
So, what Ehrlich didn't see was the revolutions that would happen in production in the 1970s. He didn't see it because he was blind to it.
I
also think he hated people.
That's the problem. Underneath all this, there's some hatred of people.
I think he hated people, and I think he hated racial minorities. And
it's very racist.
It's eugenics.
Right. I remember the Newsweek magazine cover that pushed overpopulation in the early 1970s. Every single face on the cover of that Newsweek magazine
Sub-Saharan
was brown.
African. Yeah.
Was brown.
Yeah.
And so, look, the message wasn't subtle. We don't just have too many people. We have too many of the wrong kinds of people. Yeah. Joe?
Yeah, well, I just want to say, in addition to being grossly immoral, wrong about everything and constantly rewarded for it.
Yeah.
You know, you had that quote earlier about how it's too late, no matter what we do, there's going to be this mass starvation in the 1970s. Our World in Data has a collection of just stats of global deaths from famine from 1870 to 2023. And basically what you see here, there's some huge catastrophic events. There's some famines in India. There obviously was mass starvation in Russia and in China during World War II. Then you had 36 million people between 1958 and 1962 who were killed during the Great Leap Forward, which had zero to do with overpopulation and everything to do with the cruelty and insanity of Maoist communism. So in the 1960s, about 30 million people died of famine, almost all of it completely avoidable. In the 1970s, there were terrible famines in Bangladesh, Cambodia, and Ethiopia, and yet the number of people who died of famine was low single digits, like 3 million people, 3 to 5 million people. And, I mean, this is allegedly going to just spiral out of control, and it literally doesn't matter. You can do nothing about it. Couldn't have been more wrong. I know on this show, another flannel panel, somehow we ended up talking about Paul Ehrlich a different time, and about the wager that he made in 1980 with Julian Simon about the price of materials, because he thought everything was going to get like massively expensive because of overpopulation, and none of that was true. He chose the price of five different natural resources, and the wager was that they were going to go up or down in price. All of them went down. He predicted all of them would go up. He was wrong about all of this. And then in 1990, he gets a MacArthur Prize Fellowship. Like, he becomes a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient.
Right.
So it's like this guy who's wrong about everything. As you said, the false prophet is popular because he tells people what they want to hear. In this case, there were just huge glaring signs that this guy's completely wrong about everything he's saying. And untold numbers of people died from abortion or were forcibly sterilized or were in other ways just like violently suppressed by like the Chinese one-child policy. And as you've said, we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg because that doesn't just wreck one generation. Those are a bunch of kids who don't grow up into adults, who don't have kids of their own. And then you start to see the exponential outcome of these horrendous policies of listening to a handful of wicked and foolish men.
Right.
It has been a matter, I don't know now how things stand in the Trump administration, but it has been a consistent matter of American foreign policy. There's a memorandum written by Henry Kissinger, National Security Memorandum 2000, describing how the growth of the population of what we once called the third world, now we call the developing world, were threats to American security. And that these nations needed to have aid deliberately tied to programs of sterilization. This has been American foreign policy. So it's, yes, the Chinese have done it on a scale, to be sure, but our hands are not clean.
Do either of you think, I have a feeling about this, but I don't know if I will articulate this well, but does this point to a fundamental problem in modern internationalism, which is it elevates people to positions like head of the UN agency, head of this, head of that. And that, so people are at the top of enormous systems, whether the system is Walmart or Amazon, or you have certain people that get to the top of these systems. And I think that that brings with itself an enormous temptation to try to control things that you have no right to control. And I think those temptations, like when I hear about people saying we need to control the population or we need to fix the weather, I think, are you understanding your role as a human being among other human beings? Or have you risen to such a disconnected, you know, flying on private jets around the world level of unreality that you think you actually are important and you got to control these things? This seems to me that if you're going to have a world of enormous systems, you're going to have a problem of arrogance that is almost unsoluble, it seems to me, or insolvable to me.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because it also promotes a certain kind of bureaucratic mindset,
yeah,
where you are almost hardwired for, fix it, and you're going to fix it through some bureaucratic program, and good intentions are what counts. Whether it actually works or not, whether there's any data behind it, is pretty secondary. It's what Pope Francis used to decry as ideological colonization, that you're imposing your own values, either your culture's values or just your private bureaucratic, secular liberal values upon the entire world. And this is something worth calling out. It's something worth decrying, because there's something pretty gross about that. It, you become a sort of bureaucratic crusader for a false religion. And I think it's worth acknowledging.
I think the adjective here that was in the headline of the article, diabolical, is in fact apt. I know that sometimes, like if your checkbook isn't balanced, that people try to run and find a demon in that, and maybe you're just lazy or bad at arithmetic. But the devil hates human persons. And so it is easy for me to, as a believer in God, and also I know the devil exists, it's easy for me to see his hand in a design that will reduce the number of human persons.
Right. Right. And rob mothers of their fertility, you know, where the Indian government and governments in Eastern Europe and the Chinese government robbed whole generations of women of their fertility by forcing them, inducing them, coercing them, all different methods, including just drugging them and doing it, rob them of their fertility.
Or you get a transistor radio if you get norplantone into your arm or an IUD.
Well, the worst rate of sterilization was in Puerto Rico. I mean, it
really?
Was U.S. policy. The highest in the world, I believe. I may be wrong, but for like 50 years in the 20th century.
So who's the genius that thought, what the problem with the world is we have too many Puerto Ricans? Like, really, it's maddening to think that there are people sitting in an office somewhere going, you know what we need is less Puerto Ricans. That'll solve some things for us.
Yeah, our food is too good.
Right, paella. We've got too much paella. Like, that's what that says to me, is that somebody in an office with a calculator said, we got too many Puerto Ricans.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly seems to be something like that. And it is indefensible, and it's silly. It's silly and stupid.
First of all, I would want to say there is a basic rule of human life. You can never have too many Puerto Ricans. All right, that is a fundamental law of human existence. But the second thing is this maddening hubris that we just don't seem to be able to prevent. I'll tell you one other consequence of this, and I'll let you guys comment on the other side. I'm going to tell you what I think is a consequence of this. I, at almost 62 years old, I lived through a childhood where Walter Cronkite was talking about this every week, where Huntley Brinkley were talking about this every week. There was some overpopulation story on the news. Now, fast forward to the early 2000s, where every week I'm seeing stories on the same networks about global warming. It's awful hard to convince me that global warming is a real problem. Why? I've been through this before. I've seen this show before. So what happens if global warming is a real problem? Like, and I'm supposed to pay attention to it. You've already taught me a lesson. Don't listen to you people. You're constantly henny-penny in this thing, and you need to calm down.
At the end of The Boy Who Cried Wolf, there really is a wolf.
Yeah, okay, so let's talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God. First of all, I'd like to say I love you guys' show. Specifically, it was a huge help for me when I was becoming Catholic, just getting my questions answered. I love what you guys do.
I only get to listen to you guys for about 5-10 minutes every day, but I always either learn something new or hear something new, so I love it.
Thank you for everything that you've done, and I'm sure that I'll be listening a lot more.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. A while ago, they made a movie which was a parable for the global warming thing, and it was called Don't Look Up, and it was about an asteroid that was coming to destroy the world, and people solved the problem by just not looking up, and so they didn't have to see the asteroid coming. And it was actually a pretty good movie. I didn't mind the movie at all, but it seemed to me that what they were doing is blaming people for not believing the media, where I think the people to blame are the media. They misled us for an entire generation about overpopulation. And millions of people died as a consequence of nice old Walter Cronkite every night getting on and talking to us about another overpopulation story. Nice old Walter Cronkite was selling an evil story, an anti-human evil story. So now I fast forward to the 2000s and I ask you to help me with this. It's awful hard for me to believe in global warming, not because I don't trust the science, none of that. I've been through this before. I have seen this movie. How are you going to get me to believe you now?
I'm going to tell you who you should believe, because in the population story, there is one guy who stands athwart the lie.
The Pope?
Pope St. Paul VI.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And when Rockefeller and those guys were trying to sell contraception.
Yeah.
Paul VI said, "All right, I'll think about this." No.
No, he did not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He put the kibosh on it.
He said no.
Which is a theological.
No. So
term.
A good place to look, my friends, when these kinds of things come up is, what does the church have to say?
All right. Okay. Fair enough. Joey, can you do better than that, or listen to the church?
Yeah, because I understand.
Oh, you can do better than that. You can do better than listen.
Yes, I can agree with it. Just to okay. Summarize it in a slightly different way.
Okay.
If somebody has shot their credibility, it's understandable not to believe them, even if they're telling the truth.
Yeah.
And the result there isn't just to adopt a posture of outright cynicism, but to try to find someone who is reputable, reliable, and trustworthy. And that can be difficult. Like the modern media landscape makes that hard to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of times people accumulate teachers to their own liking, but that's not really the solution. Like that's not actually a healthy way to navigate this complicated media environment.
I do want to switch gears before we go, because there was a wonderful article in Catholic Answers in the magazine section. If you go to Catholic.com and just click on the magazine section, you'll find it on the Just War Theory by Father Mosier, a Dominican, who is – it's just one of the best things I've ever read on Just War, and it's fit to our moment. And I wanted to talk about that article, but I don't think we have time, so I want to ask you a blunt question. Is it is there a moral problem with talking about ending civilizations in the context of war?
I want to put this in the strongest possible language.
It's gravely immoral.
It doesn't matter if he means.
Did
it
I steal what you were going to say, Joe? Or did
I? No. I don't know. I'm just going to say it doesn't matter if he means it or not. The defense is, he didn't carry out the threat. Look, you can get what you want in a lot of negotiations by saying, give me your purse or I'm going to murder you. And people might give you the purse and you don't actually carry out the threat. And guess what? That's
called armed robbery.
Yes.
Yeah. And by the way, it threatens death.
Yeah.
Threatening murder to get what you want is not an acceptable. It's insane that there are people who are trying to defend this or downplay it.
You can't say
stop
that.
With the partisan thinking. Imagine anyone else on earth doing this, another politician, another country's leader. This is gravely immoral. And the amount of it, we need to step back and evaluate if we're even having to question the morality of this, how things have gotten so wrong.
And the thing is, it's not a person on the street saying, I'll end a civilization. It's a person who actually has the power to end a civilization. And I think it's a disservice to the military personnel, who they are sworn not to do things like end civilizations. They don't commit mass murder. Now, I understand that there are all kinds of political considerations, but I just don't think you can get around the fact that if you're holding on to a nuclear arsenal that quite literally can end a civilization, and you make a public threat to end a civilization, you have done something immoral. You cannot do that. As the Pope said, that is unacceptable.
Yeah, well, it's gravely immoral, as Joe said, and I think, by the way, this is the expected course of human behavior once you have already set down an immoral course or an unjust course, and that is in fact the course that we have set down with this war with Iran. It does not remotely meet the Church's criteria or the natural laws criteria for a just war, either in its origin or in its prosecution.
I do not agree with that. I think it's very well said, but I don't think that it is that nearly that black and white. And part of why is I read Father Mosier's article, and he makes quite clear that the just war theory is not a checklist that you can just check items off of and say this doesn't meet. That's not how this works.
I'm going to tell you one. I'm going to tell you one right now that you have to check off, and it's called a reasonable expectation for success. And nowhere in this war that we are prosecuting against Iran is there, first of all, what success is defined as, and if there's a reasonable expectation of it. So, that criteria alone, yeah, it does not meet. It doesn't pass the justice test.
I would prefer to say what the Archbishop of the Military said, which is, I don't have the evidence that would convince me this is a just war, but I am not in a position to know those things. He may suspect it's not a just war, but I have to disagree with you that this is as black and white as you make it. I am not a supporter of war in general, or in the waging of modern war and the way we wage it, but I don't want to say something is black and white that is not black and white. It does not seem to me black and white.
Joe?
I think so I'm inclined to think that this is indefensible as a just war for the reasons Chris cited. But actually, I would say that there was no imminent threat. And I know people are saying, well, they might have been 2 weeks away. They've been saying this for 25 plus years.
Amen.
But maybe they actually meant it this time.
Again,
even if that were true, there's no imminent threat to the United States, given that we're on literally the other end of the globe and they don't have any means to. But fine. I mean, you can always say maybe there was a valid reason that no one has shown us. And I would just say we have to make moral evaluations based on what we can see. Like if you see somebody snatching a purse, maybe they're just playing and it's two friends. But you have to make a reasonable moral judgment based on the facts that are available to you, especially if you're being asked to support it. Hmm. And so if there are facts that make this a just war, I'm dubious of that, but I'm open to it.
Well,
can I say,
let me just ask you both
a
question.
Here's a third one.
But first, let me just ask you both a question. Did the United States, on the date that this started, February 27th, initiate a war with Iran or escalate a war with Iran? Which of those things happened?
Initiated.
It was an escalation of a war that's already been going on. This is why I don't think you can say that this is so clear. Again, I'm not disagreeing with you that you have a right to reach a moral conclusion, but I think it's problematic to say things are clear when they are not clear.
Here's something
that's
clear. It
seems to be obvious that there was already a war going on.
Here's something.
It's been going on for decades. And this was an escalation in that war.
So it
changes the criteria then.
I'm sorry we're running out of time here, because I don't see how this war has been going on for decades with the United States. However, I'll say a third one, declared by legitimate authority. That box is not checked.
Why?
So that's...
Who is the legitimate authority?
The Congress of the United States.
Yeah, Article 1.
I don't think just war theory is made by the U.S. Constitution. Just war theory, that is not what
I'm
the
just telling
no,
just
no,
war
but, theory but a legitimate means, authority. So, like, you and I can't start a war because we don't have the legal authority to start a war.
But the elected president
and
of
so
a country
if,
does.
If a, he doesn't.
He doesn't.
He doesn't.
Nor does he have the authority to go
not
in and take the head of state of a Latin American country by force.
This one's literally black and white, Cy, because Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution.
No, but the Constitution is not... The Constitution does not use words. Does not use words in the same way that that the just war theory uses
words. We should have led
with
this topic.
The person who is the commander in the chief does have the authority to command the forces of the United States. That is well established.
Not to declare
war. Not to declare war.
But this is not a declared war. Not all wars are declared.
It's a war.
Yes, but that's
civilians are dying. But civilians are dying.
That's without question. You are correct in that. But there's but the United States is engaged in many undeclared wars, and no court has said those are unconstitutional.
Many of them are unjust.
But what court has said that?
Adrienne Vermeule's commentary is that we might be seeing the Delphic Oracle's version of this, where she says, "If you march against the Persians, you'll destroy a great empire." So a whole civilization might have died. But it wasn't the one we thought it was going to be.
My fundamental disagreement with both of you is that things are as clear morally as you say they are. It is not a disagreement.
I'm saying we evaluate based on the evidence at hand.
Amen. I can't wait for the next flannel panel.
I will give you both the last word. That will do it for us. Joe Heschmeyer, Chris Check, thank you very much. We will see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.